Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, August 5th, 2014. The UN Refugee Agency says five more aid workers were killed today in Maban County.
We don't know exactly what's going on, but it's having a very negative impact on humanitarian operations. This is an area where you have 800 aid workers working for various humanitarian organizations.
And youth groups in Juba demand for a slot at the Addis peace talks.
We strongly demand for direct youth representation and participation in the peace process, and perhaps we suggest 7 youth delegates to independently and directly participate in the peace talk.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But first, we go to Maban County. The UN mission in South Sudan says at least 5 more aid workers have been killed in Maban County in Upper Nile State. UNMISS says 2 of the victims were murdered in Bunch Town. A third aid worker was reportedly missing but presumed dead. And another 3 died in an ambush as they were returning to the town. A militia group that calls itself the Mabanese Defense Forces is suspected of killing the aid workers. The same group is alleged to have killed a local employee of the Norwegian People's Aid Organization on Monday. UNMISS says the militia group is reportedly targeting civilians based on their ethnicity after they suffered casualties in clashes with Nuer soldiers who defected from the SPLA. UNMISS says dozens of humanitarian aid workers have taken refuge inside the main compound of the Maban County Office of the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. UNMISS dispatched a unit of peacekeepers in 4 armored personnel carriers from its base in the Upper Nile state town of Melut earlier today to protect its staff, aid workers, and civilians who have taken refuge in a UN facility. The SPLA and officials from Upper Nile state and army are reinforcing the town of Bunch in the fight with the militia. UNMISS says the targeted attacks on unarmed aid workers in Maban County will have a drastic and adverse impact on the operations of humanitarian partners in the area. The United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, says it has been forced by the violence in Bunch to delay food deliveries to tens of thousands of refugees and displaced persons in Maban County. Mungume Debs Rakarinj reports from Juba on the flare-up of violence and its impact.
UNHCR External Relations Officer for South Sudan, Fatoumate Lojene Kaba, says the fighting in Bunj started on Sunday evening and has made an already difficult humanitarian situation even worse.
Refugees are almost running out of food. The last time they had any food distributed was for a period of 15 days. So the food they have was only to last 15 days. We were about to distribute food on Monday when the situation happened, forcing us to suspend.
Lejeune Kaba says the militia, called the Mabanese Armed Forces, are harassing aid workers.
We don't know exactly what's going on, but it's having a very negative impact on humanitarian operations. This is an area where you have 800 aid workers working for various humanitarian organizations. You have 127,000 refugees from Sudan. And on top of it, now you're having civilians flee, so they're becoming internally displaced within Bunj and its surrounding areas.
Lejeune Kaba says all flights to Maban are suspended because of the fighting in the area. That means that thousands of people who depend on humanitarian airlifts for their survival may be left without food, she says.
If the situation continues to deteriorate, we will not be able to provide the food to the refugees that they're expecting. And on top of it, those who are newly displaced, the people from Bunj who now are internally displaced people, might also need humanitarian assistance, which was not the case until this fighting began.
Medicine and material to build shelters will also be in short supply until flights to Maban resume, Lejeune Kaba says. Nyakoth Yassin, the acting commissioner for Mabani County, says he visited Doru refugee camp where more than 49,000 refugees from Sudan are sheltering, and a camp of militant Nuer group, the White Army, near Bunj Hospital. He says his visits to the camps convinced him the situation in Bunj is under control.
The security situation is calm. As I speak to you, members of the security committee are next to me. I will be having a meeting with the security committee in the area later on. So I can assure you that the area is calm and the residents are coming back home.
But the UNHCR says the area is still tense. It notes that the outbreak of violence was unusual in Bunj, which was relatively peaceful until Sunday, in spite of the conflict that has impacted other parts of South Sudan, including Upper Nile State, since December 2013. For VOA News, I am Mugumedevs Ruakarinj in Juba.
The aid worker who was killed in Maban yesterday was a local employee of the Norwegian People's Aid Organization, or NPA. Katrin Radim, the head of the international department at NPA, says the worker was targeted because of his ethnicity. Radim spoke by phone from Norway with VOA fellow Nabil Biajo and told him the fighting broke out in Maban when a group of SPLA soldiers defected the army.
We had heard that there were a more unstable situation in the Maban area where the SPLA had moved some forces into the town, and some of the newer soldiers of the SPLA had deserted, and there were different groups trying to hunt down these deserters, and the whole thing escalated into an armed conflict. So we were having plans to evacuate our 13 employees that were doing emergency aid in the area. And while we were evacuating, one of our cars, NPA car, was stopped by one of these armed groups. All the people inside the car were asked to step outside, and they checked ethnic background on the people in the car. And the person who turned out to be a Nuer was directly assassinated at the place where the car was stopped.
You're saying the people behind the killing of the aid worker were government soldiers, were SPLA?
I'm not saying that directly. There's a group in Maban area which is called Maban Defense Force, which is, we don't know if it's completely controlled of the government forces, but we know that they have been fed with weapons by government forces. How much control they have over them, I don't dare to say that directly, but there's obviously a link.
What is NPA doing about this?
We are demanding an investigation from the government into what happened, and so has the UN done. So we have support from the UN of demanding a governmental investigation into what happened.
And how did the authorities in South Sudan respond to your demands or to the incident in general?
Well, as far as I know, we haven't had any response yet. At least that is what I have from Yuba so far today. We haven't yet received any response.
That's Catherine Radim, the Director of International Department at NPA, speaking to VOA fellow Nabil Biajo today from Oslo. Representatives of several youth groups meeting in Juba are demanding a seat at the table of ongoing peace talks in Addis Ababa. They also want the youth to comprise 13% of the proposed new government of national unity and a constitutional clause setting aside a third of government position for youth. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu has this report from Juba.
After meeting for 3 days in Juba last week, South Sudan's youth leaders came up with a list of demands aimed at securing a more inclusive role at the peace talks and having a significant presence in the proposed transitional government, the framework of which the two warring sides are supposed to agree on within the next couple of days. David Ali Tipo, chairperson of Youth Empowerment and Advocacy Forum, read from a position paper at today's news conference in Juba.
We strongly demand for direct youth representation and participation in the peace process, and perhaps we suggest 7 youth delegates to independently and directly participate in the peace talk.
Presidential spokesman Attorney Work Attorney says it's too early to say what role the youth will play in the next government.
The idea of everybody trying to apply for becoming part in the negotiations is non-starter. Simple because why would a youth organization want to be part of the negotiation? Who is fighting with them? Are they going to be part of rebels or are they going to be part of the government? And why youth wanted to go to Addis Ababa in order to foot their grievances in Addis Ababa? Youth are either part of the rebels if they are in the rebel control areas, or some of them part of the government if they are in the government control areas. There are youth who are part of the political parties, and there are youth who are part of civil society organizations. They should wait for the constitutional dialogue conference in order for them to raise whatever demand they wanted through a dialogue conference, not in Addis Ababa.
As it stands now, the transitional government would guarantee 25% of government positions to women. Bush Bushe Ako, chairperson of South Sudan Equatorial Students Union in Uganda, says young people want to be part of the solution to the big problems facing South Sudan. He says young people can play a positive role in ending the conflict.
Today we have come openly voicing our demands to IGAD and the international community on how we want this conflict to be resolved. Because the elders or the leaders in the government and the leaders in the opposition alone cannot bring solutions to the problem of South Sudan. We are the primary victims. When there is war, we are the ones who are facing the battlefields. So that implies that as youth of South Sudan, we can start war and we can also end the crisis.
The youth are calling on the international community to do more to pressure the warring parties to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement they signed in January.
We believe that the most effective way to end the crisis is through the use of carefully targeted regional sanctions on the parties that violate the agreement in order to promote durable political settlement.
They also stated a number of reforms they think should be enshrined in the new constitution.
Transitional inclusive government of national unity is paramount. Hence, we suggest that transitional period should be 3 years, and its mandate includes security sector reform, constitutional reform, election arrangement, education, youth employment, good governance, infrastructure, justice, national healing, peace and reconciliation.
In their position paper, which was forwarded to IGAD and the leaders of the two warring parties, the youth leaders also denounced the recruitment of child soldiers into the war. They called on young people to desist from participating in what they describe as selfish campaigns by individualistic politicians in the country. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodu in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The African Leaders Summit is in full swing in Washington. President Kiir is here, but Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is not. Find out why after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can one's culture be preserved amidst globalization?
Elders, community elders, are the backbone to ensure that young generation do not totally departed from their culture, from the cultural value that are a main core of their society and community existence.
Culture is beautiful part of our social life, and it is our culture that make what we have. There are cultures that promote discipline, culture that allow its members to respect other viewpoints. This culture are part and parcel of the global society. And it is this culture combined that makes the world we live today our world.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment. Today we are talking about malaria. The first vaccine against malaria has taken another step closer to market. It only prevents about a quarter to a half of cases. So it's not as good as most vaccines. But for a disease like malaria, which kills 600,000 people a year, it may be good enough. VOA's Steve Baragona reports.
GlaxoSmithKline's vaccine prevented just under half of malaria illnesses in children 5 to 17 months old, according to a new study in the journal PLOS Medicine. Epidemiologist Mary Hamill at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is one of the authors.
It's a pretty good vaccine, I would say. So we were looking for 30% or higher.
It prevented about a third of severe cases, the kind most likely to kill. Most vaccines are 80 to 90% effective or better, but no vaccine against a parasitic disease like malaria has ever been developed. Hamill says this disease is a special case.
So the burden of malaria is so high across sub-Saharan Africa that even with modest efficacy numbers like these, you can get a pretty high impact.
In places with high rates of transmission, children can get the disease several times a year. This vaccine could prevent a great deal of illness, she says. It prevented 27% of illnesses, but provided no protection against severe disease. And Hamill notes it lost its punch over the course of the 18-month study.
It did decline more rapidly than one would hope, and that's why the impact of the booster is going to be very important.
The researchers will be testing whether booster shots prolong protection. Dr. Chris Plow at the University of Maryland School of Medicine is one of many experts saying the vaccine is an important step forward.
We don't really have a silver bullet. This is a first-generation vaccine, and we'd all like to see a vaccine that has 100% protective efficacy. But in the context of how well we expect to do with a really tough disease like malaria, this is actually pretty good and reason for some celebration, I would say.
But tempering that celebration, Brown University malaria researcher Dr. Jonathan Curtis wonders whether a vaccine that prevents relatively few deaths will be worth the cost.
Who is going to pay to deliver this vaccine, which is not a cheap vaccine to manufacture? Will they pay to stop 20 cases per 1,000 participants per year and a half? And I can't answer that.
GlaxoSmithKline has applied for approval from European regulators. The company has not disclosed what the price of the vaccine will be, but it says it will cover the cost of manufacturing plus 5%, which will be reinvested in vaccine research. David Caslow is vice president for product development at PATH, one of the major donors to the malaria vaccine effort. He says there is still a lot to learn before the vaccine would be deployed, but he adds,
for the foreseeable future, this is what we have. Is it perfect? No, but is it a good start? Yes.
Several other vaccines are in development, but they are all years away. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Washington.
Here in Washington, U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting a summit of African leaders in an effort to strengthen American ties with the continent. But Zimbabwe, which desperately needs investment from abroad, will not be represented because of President Robert Mugabe's tainted human rights record. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare on what that means for Zimbabwe.
Trade and investment issues are an important part of the three-day U.S.-Africa summit taking place this week in Washington. Talking to African journalists by telephone ahead of the meeting, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas Greenfield said the summit was a historic event.
The theme of the summit is investing in the next generation. We think this reflects the common ambitions that we share with the people and governments of Africa to leave our nations better for future generations by making gains in peace and security and good governance and economic development. So this is going to be an extraordinarily productive and fruitful discussion.
But one of those missing that fruitful discussion is Zimbabwean leader Robert Mugabe. The 90-year-old Zimbabwean leader is subject to U.S. travel and financial sanctions because of his poor human rights record and history of alleged election rigging. He joins Sudanese Omar al-Bashir, Eritrea's Isaias Afwerki, and Central African Republic's Catherine Samba-Panza on the small list of African leaders excluded from the summit. Pedzisai Ruhanya, who heads the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, says Zimbabwe stands to lose a lot by not being represented at this summit.
So the meeting in Washington is important for international trade among those countries that are meeting Obama, and also countries that are looking for foreign direct investment. They will be interacting with American conglomerates and international business institutions that want to invest in developing economies, economies such as Nigeria is now the leading economy in Africa, followed by South Africa. So it's important that those countries meet, particularly in America, where the heartbeat of international business is.
Zimbabwe's economy has alternated between depression and weak growth for nearly 15 years, ever since Mr. Mugabe's government began to forcibly drive white commercial farmers off their land. Foreign companies are generally reluctant to invest in the country because of political turmoil and Mr. Mugabe's nationalistic economic policies. Zimbabwe's Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister, Christopher Mutswangwa, agrees with Ruhanya that the summit is crucial for Africa. But when it comes to Zimbabwe, he says the government is at peace not being present for the discussions.
Of course, we as Zimbabwe, we are not invited. You know, we have no misgivings whether we are, when America decides to exclude us. It's a country which has never been comfortable with an assertive African nationalist. We brook no strictures from anybody, including America.
I asked Ruhanya if Mr. Mugabe's exclusion had something to do with his assertive nationalism.
No, it's not about his uprightness or otherwise to the West, but it has to do with how he governs his country. You know, the kind of, economic undergrowth that we've seen has nothing to do with the West. America is averse to authoritarian regimes, averse to authoritarian practices, averse to patrimonial regimes, and that's why Mugabe is not there. That's why he was not invited by Obama. Also to do with the outcome of the election last year.
The Obama administration was one of the Western governments that refused to recognize Mr. Mugabe's re-election in July 2013, which the opposition MDC party says was rigged. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Sudanese officials are describing the decision by President Obama to exclude Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir from attending the largest gathering of African leaders in the United States as abnormal. VOA fellow Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
The three-day African Leaders Summit kicked off yesterday in Washington, D.C., where nearly 50 African heads of state have come to discuss issues affecting the continent. Only four African presidents were not invited. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir, the only acting head of state who has an outstanding warrant by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, is one of them. Sudanese ambassador to the U.S. Muawiya Khalid says ignoring Mr. Bashir makes the Sudanese government feel isolated.
Isolation is not a good option for developing Africa, for the future of the African nations. It's better for United States foreign policy in Africa to engage with all African countries to work together because there is a lot to share with these African countries and African nations.
The U.S. government placed sanctions on Sudan more than a decade ago for alleged human rights violations and repression of freedoms by the Islamist regime in Khartoum. But Ambassador Khalid says sanctions will not help mend relations between Sudan and the U.S.
It is high time for U.S. to review the policy of the sanctions because it's not going to lead to anywhere rather than to complicate the life of the normal citizens.
Sudanese political analyst Mehdi Al-Jizuli says it's not surprising Mr. Bashir was not invited, given his record as much as it displaces Khartoum.
They're very aware that it's a bit difficult for anybody to invite him to the U.S. anyway. That's why it's not an issue in the Khartoum press, nor is it an issue in media coverage and stuff.
Al-Jizuli says Sudan's poor human rights record, especially in Darfur, southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states, along with Khartoum's form of Sharia law, are reasons for the isolation. John Temin, Director of Africa Programs at United States Institute of Peace and a longtime observer of politics in Sudan and South Sudan, agrees. He says the U.S.-Sudan relations will improve only once the government in Khartoum addresses human rights abuses in Sudan and puts an end to the near-constant aerial attacks on its citizens.
The relationship depends on what happens on the ground in Sudan and Sudan's efforts to address the ongoing wars in Darfur and in southern Kordofan and in Blue Nile. And I think the U.S. is probably looking for real movement in those areas in order for the bilateral relationships to progress.
Nabil Biagio, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. A second major airline has suspended flights to parts of West Africa because of the deadly Ebola outbreak in the region. British Airways said today it is suspending flights to and from Liberia and Sierra Leone due to the deteriorating public health situation in both countries. It says the suspension is due to run until August 31st. The Dubai-based airline Emirates suspended its service to Guinea on August 2nd. The three countries are the epicenter of the Ebola outbreak that has killed nearly 900 people in the region this year. A man wearing an Afghan army uniform opened fire on international troops, killing at least one U.S. officer today in what appears to be the country's latest so-called insider attack. The International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF, confirmed that one American officer had been killed. ISAF released few details, saying only that the shooting involved both Afghan and international forces and that it took place at the Marshal Fahim National Defense University in Kabul. In addition to the American who died, a U.S. official says another 15 international soldiers, including Americans, were wounded. And finally, a 72-hour ceasefire between Israel and Hamas took effect early today in the Gaza Strip as efforts to intensify to negotiate a long-term end to the conflict. Just before the truce began at 8 a.m. local time, Israel announced it would pull its remaining troops from the coastal enclave. An army spokesman told reporters soldiers will be redeployed in defensive positions outside Gaza. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Bon Frère by a Ghanaian musician, Afore Mposa. We have been listening to Afore Mposa with the song Bon Frère. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.